Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Good afternoon, Charlie. How are you doing?
I am great, Tim.
Shalom.
What are you drinking there, Charlie?
Shalom.
Cultural like appropriation. Thinkling appropriation.
Oh, ooh, I love it.
I love it.
Josh, you're great. Howdy. We'll go with the howdy. I haven't done a howdy in a while.
What I have here is some kombucha.
Ooh.
From
the Nordstrom's. Ooh. And so they send it to the Thinklings, and they would like to formally and cordially invite any listeners who would like to come to the Hobbit Hole. It's like an all-day eating festivity, and you've been to it multiple times. Have you been to it, Charlie?
I have never.
Okay. Josh, you haven't been to it. I've been to it once.
I celebrate privately.
Oh. But they will open their home for an entire day, and if you search for it on Facebook, or he sent me the link so we can put it in the show notes. It's in a couple of weeks, and there's just lots of food and fellowship, and they sing, and you can drop in anytime you want throughout the day. It's kind of like a all-day graduation party kind of a feel, so it's very nice. So the kombucha is very good. I when I grabbed the bottle, I accidentally wiped off the label of the flavor. I can't even guess. I have no idea. No idea, but it's very, very good. What do you think, Charlie?
I don't know.
Charlie just took a sip.
The silence there was me tasting it and trying to decide what I think. I don't know. It's some fruit, maybe. Yep. I don't
citrusy.
Know.
Citrusy. It's very good.
I will contend the best kombucha I've ever had.
Ooh.
Or like, maybe best isn't the right qualifier. My favorite flavor is I made a jalapeno kombucha like 4 or 5 years ago. And that sounds so off-putting. It was amazing. It was surprisingly good.
I'm going to guess this is pineapple.
Was it the mother of all kombuchas?
It was. That's just a bad idea. I don't even know.
It was so good. It was so good. It's like peanut butter on pizza. It just, you think it's bad, but it is surprisingly good.
Okay.
So Charlie, the best, like...
Don't bury the lead. We're talking about peanut butter on pizza now.
Oh, I know. But I'm going to talk about kombucha a little bit more. Literally the best sip of kombucha I've ever had is I dropped off something at your house once and you had made some, like, I don't know if it was raspberry or something kombucha. It was like, I can still taste the sip. It was so good. So do you still make kombucha?
I
did you give up the,
so
did you hang up your vinegar bottle?
I didn't intentionally.
Okay.
When I moved from Ankeny to Grimes, I forgot my jars with my SCOBYs in my former apartment.
They gone.
And there's probably a good chance that due to where I stored them, that the new residents don't even know they're there.
Was it down, like in the furnace closet?
It was in the furnace closet where you're not supposed to put things, but you want it to be warmer.
Oh, yeah.
But so
is there a chance that it's like smelling at this point?
It probably wouldn't smell. Well, maybe. I don't know.
Can you imagine being the person who rented Charlie's old place and they go in to do something with the furnace? They're like, what is this thing in the jar? It's alive.
It wasn't one jar. There was three of them.
Oh, my word.
They're aliens.
I actually had they're called the SCOBY Hotel where you can like put multiple SCOBYs in. And I did have one. So there's just a jar full of those.
Oh, my word. That's funny.
Yeah,
I would almost pay money to see the expression on the person's face when they find the.
So here's what's in this episode.
SCOBYs.
This episode is a SCOBY hotel. Lots of SCOBYs. We're gonna do books and business, and then we are gonna talk about the essay "Is Theology Poetry from the Weight of Glory?" But as always, Tim.
Books and business.
We should talk about some books, and I will go first. And I have been reading. Is Theology Poetry? So I've been reading The Weight of Glory. I think that's just going to be my discussion for my topic for our books and business. Yeah.
I've been reading Complementarity some more by Greg Allison. But what I want to talk about today is Only the Lover Sings, Art and Contemplation by Joseph Pieper. Joseph Pieper's written a couple of books on leisure. I think Josh is going to be doing something with a leisure at some point.
Well, I am now.
Woo! I love it. I read that book like 5 years ago and was quite lost, and so I'm looking forward to what you have to say about it. So his first chapter is work, spare time, and leisure. Have you guys ever thought about the terminology spare time? What is spare time?
No, but I'm very curious.
There's only one other context in which I know of there's two. There's a spare tire, and then there's like when you're bowling.
It's funny, when you said spare time, the first thing I thought of was spare Sorry.
It's like something extra that you don't really, you know, need. So spare time is a multi-layered concept. As long as it is defined negatively as a span of time not filled with work, no problem arises. Similarly, if we consider the concept of spare time only in its relationship to the concept of a work day, if we define spare time as a mere break from work in order to recover a time after work to restore one's strength for more work, then again, no particular problem will arise. So in other words, as we think through our non-working times, how do we define or even look at them as a time to recover from work so then we can go back to work, then what is it that we're actually living for? We're actually living to work. So he refers to like the totalitarian work state. So this is really helpful. He later states in verse 18 or page 18, the totalitarian work state, and then seeking to create a definition of leisure. And then considering the feast that you were talking about, one of the things that is very much a contrary to the whole work totalitarian work state where we just work all the time. It's something I kind of struggle with. This second condition in a nutshell is this, the ability to celebrate a feast. And then he talks about what is required to celebrate a feast. So speaking of feasting, a good way to have some leisure is to celebrate a feast and come to the Hobbit Hole.
Nicely done.
Hear, hear. I raised my kombucha glass.
Well, I had the privilege this week and last week, I guess, of reading through The Death of Ivan Ilyich with my students. And it's by Leo Tolstoy. And the story, of course, begins with Ivan already dead. And you're at his funeral, I guess. And some of his quote-unquote friends are milling about with his wife. But the first line of chapter two, so it's a novella, 12 short chapters. The first line of chapter two is this. Ivan Ilyich's life had been most simple and most ordinary and therefore most terrible. And it's kind of a shocking line because in our culture, we would often consider a life that is most simple and most ordinary to be quite a pleasurable life. But the contention within this work is that that's not a pleasurable life, and that is what Ivan had been pursuing. And he's confronted with his mortality when he contracts a serious, fatal, and mysterious illness. And so you get to see him wrestling with his mortality throughout the rest of the work.
I'm reading for the Path Group at church, Biblical Exegesis, A Beginner's Guide by Hayes and, man, the name's not, Holiday, Hayes and Holiday. And this is the fourth edition. So Hayes has already gone to be with the Lord, and Holiday is the main writer. In the first chapter, he's talking about what the word exegesis means, and I just really enjoyed, we talk about this in Intro to Bible Study, it's from a Greek word that means to lead out, or to lead the way, or to expound, and then sometimes to interpret. And so then he talks about interpretation, and he makes this point, which I have enjoyed. He says, because we spend so much time speaking and listening, we ask questions intuitively. We recognize that facial gestures and body language may communicate as much as a spoken word or perhaps more at times. As we interpret a speech act, we trigger a multifaceted, complex range of responses that may seem second nature to us. And so he says, we may not even give much conscious attention to how we respond. Even so, when we participate in such acts of interpersonal communication, we are using our exegetical skills. So sometimes in Greek or in intro to Bible study, when we're going through the observational stuff, students feel like it's a bit tedious. Like, why do we do this just with the Bible? And I would say we don't. And your bringing poetry has actually demonstrated another area. We do this all the time, Josh. But because it's a different world, it's a different context, and it's a different setting, and because, especially like when you're in Greek or another language, you don't think in that language and you don't communicate in that language. So the exegetical tools we have developed are like guardrails, or the illustration I use in Intro to Bible Study, it's like those bumpers that guard the gutters when you go bowling and you're a little kid. It keeps you from rolling a gutter ball. And so I just thought that was an interesting thought. So listener, if you are using tools to help you understand the Bible and sometimes you think, shouldn't I just be able to read this and get it? You can get communication that's in your current context and in the way you think right now, but using a tool is not a failure. It's just a helpful thing when the information you're studying is outside of your normal context. So I thought that was an interesting little nugget. So don't be afraid of using tools.
What's the name of the book?
Biblical Exegesis, A Beginner's Guide by Hayes and Holiday. It was recommended. I don't know if it'll be good or not. I've only read 25 pages, so I'd say my 25-cent book review of it is like, it's pretty good, but that's only worth a quarter at this point.
Lovely. All right, let's jump into our main content. Yep. Tim has a copy of it.
The second edition. I have the fourth.
Yeah, mine's old.
Is that the same Hayes of like Carter Duvall and Hayes of like grasping?
He's Richard Hayes. He's written some stuff on typology, and he's written
Echoes. Yeah, he's the Echo guy.
Yeah.
He's the Echo guy. I just echoed what you said. All right, so let's get to our main content. That right there, that was a beautiful moment. So
that was really quick.
I wasn't expecting it either.
And he was right on it.
I wasn't expecting it either. It was just got me. Good job, Charlie. You got me.
I wasn't expecting it either. I'm sorry. Okay. The essay from The Weight of Glory that we're talking about today is Theology Poetry? And so I'm going to give a brief summary, and then I have some discussion points for us to attack. So the question, is theology poetry, was a question given to C.S. Lewis, and this essay is his response in the Socratic Club of Oxford College in 1944. It is important to note, and this is what he says in the opening paragraph, that this is not his topic. This question was given to him. And really, to catch the sense of the question, it's not, is theology being written like poetry for Christians? Are we trying to create a poetry for Christians? The sense of the question is an answer to an accusation that Christians do theology because it gives them a similar pleasure to their imagination that poetry gives to people as they read or write poetry. So he supplies the kind of more expanded question, is theology merely poetry? Is it just some Christian version of poetry? He says this in the third paragraph, does theology offer us at best only that kind of truth which, according to some critics, poetry offers us? So poetry isn't the best vehicle for communicating direct truth, but it helps you feel things that are true, helps cultivate affections to think on certain things. And is theology, in a sense, a poetic way of communicating beliefs about Christianity? He continues to expand the question, does Christian theology owe its attraction to its power of arousing and satisfying our imaginations? That's in paragraph 3. Another good way of asking it, are those who believe theology, mistaking aesthetic enjoyment for intellectual assent? So I think that right there is the heart of the question he's being posed at a college. Are we when we study theology, are we confusing an intellectual enterprise with a imaginative, poetical enterprise, as if poetry doesn't involve the intellect. But His answer, kind of right off the cuff, is if theology is poetry, it's bad poetry. He says that at the end of paragraph 3. And he then launches for quite a bit of the discussion explaining why theology would be bad poetry. He compares it to other poetical things and, for himself at least, says Christian theology doesn't match up to other works of poetry. He then compares Christian theology to other quote-unquote theologies, other worldviews, and he actually says that like an atheistic or scientific worldview is a much more poetical story. Humans rising out of nothing with random chance and eventually conquering nature, that's a better story than God made us. He said for its poetical advantages, Christianity would not be his choice. So for Lewis, is theology just poetry? It's just a choice you're making on aesthetic grounds. His answer is clearly no, it's not.
Because evolution is a better story.
Among
Greek mythology is a better story.
Pantheism.
He says that here.
There's a couple of quotes in there.
The majestic simplifications of pantheism and the tangled wood of pagan animism both seem to me in different ways more attractive.
Yeah. Paragraph 5, if Christianity is only a mythology, and using mythology parallel to the idea of poetry, then I find the mythology I believe in is not the one I like. I like Greek mythology much better, Irish better still, and Norse best of all. If I was choosing based on imaginative arousal, I wouldn't choose Christianity. Or no, that's not his statement. That's my summary of his statement. Then really the middle third to back end of the essay really becomes apologetic in why he did choose Christianity, why Christians are believing theology. It's not that theology or Christian ideas have zero imaginative appeal or zero pleasure to them. There are aspects of theology that become like poetry or poetic to us. But he makes the case that his choice of Christian theology was intellectual. That is, he thought about the scientific view of the world. It broke down rationally for him. And he has written on this in numerous other places. But very clearly, he couldn't believe the one he liked because it wasn't rational.
Was that the fairies?
No, it's this little after the fairies.
Oh, okay.
He makes a comment about fairies talking about how Christian theology has less value poetically because you enjoy the idea of fairies until they're real. Like if fairies were real in your life, you probably wouldn't like them as much is kind of the sense of it. But anyway, and then so he answers the question, is theology merely a poetry? We're making a choice for these beliefs because of the aesthetic pleasure they bring. And he says no. Towards the end of the essay, he thinks two other ways of thinking, like two other lines by which we may call theology merely poetry. One of those lines of thinking is that Christian theology shares and has very many similar elements to other early writings or stories, savage religions, as he calls them. And so those savage religions or mythologies are very poetic to us. And so based on the similarity that some of Christian theology bears to those other stories, there's a line of thinking, well, it's just one of these poetical mythological stories. And then his other line of thinking is that Christian theology uses a lot of symbolism in the way it explains things. And he follows those two lines out to say, even still, he would not call theology merely a poetry. Line number one, he basically says, wouldn't we expect all the pagans to borrow things from the one true myth? Which I know Tim doesn't like the one true myth language, but that's in essence his argument, is that this is the one that's real, and all these other ones, because they're men made in the image of God, they're all grasping parts of the truth, but they're getting lots of it wrong.
It's his definition of myth. And because he always qualifies it as a true myth, I don't really have a problem with it.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, thank you.
This is not, we're not going to get into Lewis's definition of myth, because that is a whole nother bag of cats. And then his second discussion, the use of symbols, he basically says all language is metaphor, which I think he had a friend named Owen Barfield who was probably pretty formative in this regard. There is no describing of anything that doesn't eventually use metaphor. That's what language is. So it's impossible for the Christian or for the atheist to describe what they believe without the use of symbol. So Christian theology isn't just poetry because it uses symbolism. All language uses symbolism. So those are kind of his three lines that he goes down. His overarching answer would be no, theology is not poetry. I want to return to the very beginning of the essay, and this is where we'll dive into some discussion, perhaps. In the he does a very Lewis-y thing. He states the question, and then he seeks to define his terms. So in paragraph 2, he is defining what theology is, and he calls it this: the systematic series of statements about God and about man's relation to him, which the believers of a religion make. So I just wanted to pose that to the table. What do we think about Lewis's definition of theology? And this is unscripted, unprompted, so their silence is them thinking. Look at all those lovely thoughts.
I don't know how much I have a problem with it, but I haven't had a whole lot of time to contemplate it. So it's a systematic series, and it's statements about God. I don't know about the man's relationship to him part.
I was just going to say, I think he includes too much. Because he says it's statements about God's relation to man. That's part of theology, but in general, it's just theology is what you believe to be true about God, which that's part of it. So I don't know, maybe that's just a bit precise, but I'm not opposed in principle.
When you think like man's relation to him, that could be like a doctrine of sin or a doctrine of soteriology.
It's just more specific.
Yeah. I'm just saying, if I only talked about God, but I never talk about man, then I couldn't say I'm being theological. I think it's okay.
Is there anything you think should be added, or the surprise is not there?
What do you think, Charlie?
That's not important. So I guess when I, before I read the essay, where I thought he was going to go would be in the sense of creeds. Like hit with his... Anglican slash Catholic influence, that he would be interacting with some of the creeds, the Nicene Creed, maybe most specifically, that he probably knew and had recited at times. And I'm kind of surprised that his definition doesn't include, he doesn't ever interact with like creeds of the church.
When he says a systematic series of statements, do you think he would include creeds under that definition?
He might. I don't know. I guess I figured that that's kind of what, because that when we read a creed, it's so different than how we normally write or how we normally talk, that it reads in a more poetic sense. And so that's what I thought he was talking about. But when we think about theology, we're usually not thinking like creeds modern today, especially as Protestant evangelicals, you know, so
Baptists, what,
Protestant evangelical Baptists.
Yeah. Cause the other Protestant evangelicals would definitely be down with the creeds. So
teach their own. All right.
I would say being hit cold with it, I don't see anything, but I also would say I haven't given enough time to think.
Yeah.
Think about it. So, but yeah, nothing majorly controversial. What do you think? There's something missing?
Not necessarily. Okay. No. I guess I was posing the question kind of as Josh did. Like, is he referring to, like, as far as I know, like every mass they recite the Nicene or whatever they call it, creed. And then I don't know how Anglicans practice that, but I'm sure there's similarities And so is he referring to that? Like, I believe in the only Son of God, the, you know, Son of Mary, like those types of statements, where when we hear theology, the term, we don't think in creed, but maybe he was. I do think it's interesting too. He does make he distinguishes that we are talking about Christian theology, and he's made a statement about, you know, Greeks didn't write out their beliefs about the gods, you know, so that is a pretty unique Christian thing.
By the way, so we're reading the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Aeneid this semester in the honors program, and that drives students crazy that there is no systematic treatment of Zeus. In each work that you read, he's a little bit different. He does different things, right, even from book to book sometimes. And so it's been interesting.
But you can do that when you're making it up on the fly.
Oh, no.
What? Are you going to say that I'm on air, Josh? Okay.
Is Mormonism theology? No. Okay. So now let's go to paragraph 3, and we're going to do the same thing. He defines poetry, and if I was to place Lewis in a field, he's much more a poet than he is a theologian, and I think he would say that too. And so he says, when he's asking, is theology poetry, he's not asking, is theology written in a verse, which makes me think creeds are kind of written in that they don't have verse, but they feel like they do. There's a little bit more to them. He's not asking if theologians have poetic style. That's where the idea of merely poetry comes up. He does define poetry as writing which arouses and in part satisfies the imagination. Writing which arouses and in part satisfies the imagination. And he intentionally is trying to give a very vague definition of poetry. But guys, mostly Josh, but guys, what do you think about... No, I said guys, mostly Josh. But also, what do you think about his definition or idea of poetry?
I want to hear from the others.
That's a strong move.
Charlie, when you said mostly Josh, I just thought of mostly peaceful protest. That's literally what I thought.
I kind of primed the pump the other day on this. I told Josh, he's like, I'm going to ask, you know, you guys as well, but I'm interested to hear what he thinks about that definition of poetry, but...
Well, at first, that probably does strike us as an almost useless definition of poetry because it includes so much. But he is purposely being broad. And I talk about this often with my students. It's actually quite difficult to define poetry. Many times students think it is verse. So they would say things like it rhymes and it has a specific meter. And Lewis and others would say, not necessarily, not all verse is poetry, and not all poetry is verse. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting that you have to think through the ways in which we talk about literature. We think of things such as novels and short stories and poetry, and we have these categories. But from an ancient context, poetry are these oral stories that are being told, things that are being sung. It's all poetry. And it's creative and it appeals to the imagination. So I think I'm in favor of this broad definition. It sounds silly to say because it's C.S. Lewis. Of course I'm in favor. But
no, rip it to shreds.
But I think with those kind of considerations in mind, it maybe makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it's interesting because that which arouses and in part satisfies the imagination would include many more things than I would originally think about when I think of poetry. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. I had a debate with a friend once about whether a poem has to rhyme or not. And they were like, no, it doesn't. It's just something that you make. It's something that you create. And I'm like, that can't be. And then I looked up like what the word poem comes from. And I'm like, okay, fine. But I think when someone blathers on a page and then says that's a poem, and then someone writes something really skillful, one of those is clearly better. And I can make this thing over here. So anyways, I would grant it. But if it's something that satisfies the imagination, man, there's a lot of things that we would have to call poems or poetry.
Like theology.
Well, and that's where when you were, this whole thing is theology, poetry. I get to this part, I'm like, oh, that's where he's going. It was a little surprising. Mm-hmm. The title was Arrest, or it was like, it'd be a good blog post in 2026.
Yeah.
Is theology poetry if he was a writer?
No comment.
Tim, so I was ready for you to say, oh, it really sounds like Lewis is borrowing some ideas from his good friend Owen Barfield in Poetic Diction.
I read Poetic Diction like how long ago, and I understood like a tenth of it.
And it was not poetry to you.
It was not poetry to me.
But but Tim is, I mean, Tim, you're an Old Testament guy, and you teach in wisdom literature, so you do have things to say about poetry.
Well, I mean, poetry, I go through a whole thing on defining poetry, and it's the same thing that you already said. I basically say, well, is it prose or is it poetry? And I give characteristics of each. Is Genesis 1 prose or poetry? And I say how it's poetry, and I show how it's prose. And so I kind of play with that tension. So
in the documents that have Hebrew, you know, when we look at an English translation, it sets the poetry.
It does.
It sets it out in the text. But in the originals, it was it that way or was it not that way?
Some of it was, but we don't know, like, how it was transmitted completely. So I use as an illustration, I should rephrase. Okay, so it was not transmitted in verse, but the Masoretes did make it into verse in the medieval time period, but only some of it. And then there's actually debate because when they're transcribing, I actually went to SBL and they were talking about this. They're like, do we copy the Masoretic verse? Or when we know that something is verse, should we put it into verse? And they were debating it. And you have different editors doing different books of the Bible and they're doing it differently.
Yep.
And I was like, you got to be kidding me. You guys need to be at least following the same rules. So if it's in verse, sometimes it's coming from the Masoretic text and sometimes it's the editor of the Hebrew Bible that's putting it into verse. So it's extremely subjective. So right now I have BHS and BHQ, two Hebrew Bibles, mm-hmm. and I like comparing them because it's two different editors that are putting it into Hebrew verse.
So I think Genesis 1 actually becomes a really helpful illustration that we do believe it's historical, and it is, in a sense, a narrative that's unfolding, but because of its origins, because of its mythological character or characteristics, that it so easily does something imaginative in someone when they're reading and thinking about it. And so that becomes, that's a really good example.
I just thought of another really good example.
Oh boy.
Well,
he has that look.
Oh no.
There's this podcast trouble. I know.
Oh boy.
It's very imaginative. Definitely gets you thinking. I think our podcast must be poetry.
Mm. Oh, wow.
That's a good...
I mean, on this good definition.
I know, right. Exactly. That's good.
Was so that like, motion throwing out the baby with the bathwater, Tim?
No, it just illustrates the problem with the definition. So in Hebrew, yes. You have verse and stuff. So like Isaiah 14, 1-3, most people say it's not poetry. And there's only one English translation that makes it poetry. It's the NIV. And I think they're right. So just as an illustration, the Hebrew Bible does not make it poetry. Most English Bibles follow the Hebrew Bible in not making it poetry. The NIV goes contrary to the Hebrew Bible and makes it poetry, and I believe correctly so.
Andy, your homework this week is to look up the definition of the word doggerel.
Oh, I'm going to do this.
So I do think most people, when they hear poetry, they think something that's lyrical. Can you be quiet over there, you pagan? So when Josh, your students say something like, oh, it rhymes or it's lyrical, I do think people attempting to write poetry often adopt those forms to cue that that's what they're doing. But that doesn't mean that what they're producing is poetic. You know, it could be in the form of poetry, but not necessarily poetic. Just the same that like a Genesis 1 may not have been written in the form that we would expect of poetry.
Right.
But it is very poetical.
Yes. And that's a good way to put it, Charlie, yeah. Because I don't believe that Genesis 1 is poetry, mm-hmm. but it is poetical. And this is where Barfield helps, because Barfield, he kind of blows up the distinctions between poetry and prose. He rips
things that weren't poetry,
right,
and you read them, and to you, it's like, oh.
It is, right.
Yeah. All right, so maybe diving in to... Hush you. So, again, I think he adopts this language of accusation in paragraph 7. The accusation that Christians are believing what they believe because of the poetic nature of it. And he's clearly saying, no, that's not what we're doing. And he uses a really good illustration here. I'm going to read the quote. He's speaking of children. It pleases their, the children's imagination, to pretend that they are bears or horses. But I do not remember that one was ever under the least delusion. So it's like kids, they do things out of their imagination. They pretend that they're something they're not because it pleases them. But they don't actually believe that they are those things. Like, they understand that they're doing make-believe. And so, thinking about Christians and the idea of how someone engages with one of these myths, so there is a disconnect between the pleasure that something arouses in you and whether or not you believe it to be actually true. And I think that's a really helpful distinction, that Christians aren't just believing the thing that really sparks their imagination. They believe it to be true, and it does have some aesthetic points to it, but it's not purely poetical. They're not making the decision on those grounds. He actually says, he pretty much interacts the whole time about how you may believe something and that might lead you to enjoy it in a different way, but it's a different way of enjoying than you would enjoy fairies or the Trojan Wars, something like that. Here's a quote. In this sense, Christianity, life force worship, Marxism, Freudianism, all become poetries to their own believers. That believing in something does bring enjoyment in knowing what's true. But, this is in paragraph 8, this does not mean that their adherents have chosen them for that reason. On the contrary, this kind of poetry is the result, not the cause of belief. Theology is, in this sense, poetry to me because I believe it. I do not believe it because it is poetry. And that, I think, is a really interesting line. I'm going to read it again, and I want to see if it sounds familiar to something else. Theology is, in this sense, poetry to me because I believe it. I do not believe it because it is poetry.
It sounds like his quote, I don't believe in... Christianity, or I don't believe in the sun because I see it, but because I see everything else by it, which I think is at the end of Way to Glory, or in the beginning of it?
It's at the end of this essay.
This
is theology poetry.
Okay. Okay.
He uses that line in multiple essays, which also, you know, he's written something, he's preparing a paper and a talk for this other club, and he's borrowing from something he's already said. I guess I don't know which one was the one that came first, but Josh mentioned this last week, that that line is in Meditations in a Tool Shed, I believe.
Did he just pull a Peter O'Brien?
You have to tell me what you mean.
Well,
plagiarizing.
Plagiarizing himself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, not that
funny. Writing a good commentary? I don't know. So when I read that line, I thought it bore some resemblance to that final line. And so the final line of the essay, did I put it in my notes? Of course I didn't.
I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else.
So this is really the context of that quote.
Well, I don't know.
Or partly.
Well, the sun, poetry, the imagination.
Well, I don't know which place he used that quote first. I didn't do that sleuthing. So I don't know if he put it in the other essay first and then he brought it over here into this essay, or if he put it here first and then he dumped it into another essay. But what I thought was interesting is how those phrases read sort of similarly. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what he's saying about theology, is that it's not like I believe it because of you know, this enjoyment. Yeah, it has enjoyment, but through theology, that brings all the rest of the joy and the enjoyment. Like that is how he's now going to see everything else. And that's kind of the last half of the essay, is him sharing testimony about, he's already said, I loved all of these other mythologies more, and I was grappling with science, with naturalism, with evolution, and he intellectually was sifting through those things, and it wasn't the enjoyment of the thing that founded his belief. It's that he started thinking through the ideas themselves, and Christian theology came to the forefront because it made sense of all the other stuff. And he has this whole diatribe in here of how if you start with science, there is zero room for theology. You're all material. None of this stuff makes sense. You can't take any good parts of Christian theology and force it into science. They don't mix if you start with science. But if you start with Christian theology, there are things that are true that our observation of the universe has given us that you can bring in. One of them includes all of the others. So by the one, you see all the others. And so he that's where he's wrapping that by the sun, I see everything into his discussion of is theology poetry? And that's where I think that famous quote came before this essay. The question being posed to him, well, do you just believe Christian theology because it's like all those other Norse mythologies that you love? And he's, no, Christian theology would be really bad poetry. All that other stuff is way better. The reason I believe Christian theology is because it most makes sense of the world. And he so he kind of, the discussion is not about poetry anymore. It's just apologetic. And so that's where he lands in that same zone he's been at before, that I believe this because it's the way that I now see everything. And it's not because of its poetic value, it's because it's true. And so I think that's where he eventually lands in here. There are some really, really good quotes that we just don't have time to really dive into. There's one where he like takes a shot at Freud, and I would love to find it. Where are you?
Well, there we while go. You find that, let me read this little quote. The caveman and the evolution thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He becomes the caveman with his club and his flints, muttering and growling over his enemy's bones, dragging his screaming mate by her hair. I never could quite make out why, he puts in parentheses, tearing his children to pieces in fierce jealousy till one of them is old enough to tear him. It's like the story of evolution and how it's mythic and is a good, quote unquote, yeah. story.
Okay. So can you actually reminded me of a point I wanted to make.
Yeah.
Can you keep reading in that? Because mm-hmm. eventually he's going to talk about in the science view of mankind and evolution, that eventually mankind is going to triumph over nature until nature fizzles itself out. Like the sun dims and everything dies. Like, so can you find that and read in that? It's a tall task here.
Man has ascended his throne. There henceforward, he has nothing to do but to practice virtue, to grow in wisdom, to be happy, and now mark the final stroke of genius. If the myth stopped at that point, it might be a little pathetic. I don't know what pathetic is.
So it would be overdone or anticlimactic.
Oh, anticlimactic. Yeah. So instead it doesn't end. The sun will cool. All sins will cool. The whole universe will run down. Life, every form of life, will be banished without hope of return from every inch of infinite space. All ends in nothingness and universal darkness covers all.
Okay. So what's interesting about this, he prepares and gives this talk in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
Andy, what is he writing at the same time?
When?
1944.
Well, I think it's That Hideous Strength.
He's going to publish That Hideous Strength in 1945, which in that series, he's talking about the scientific views of the men in that Hideous Strength.
Fine. I'll read it again this summer, okay? But you don't need to bring it up in every episode.
But so I'm not bringing it up. I think Lewis is thinking about that when he's writing this essay. That's what's happening in that Hideous Strength is that the scientific men think that they're like the pinnacle of evolution. They've now conquered man and they're like making gods. And what's actually happening, that's science has no, can't fit Christian theology in at all. The scientific men in that Hideous Strength think that they're gods conquering nature. What's actually happening is not nature conquering man. They're being manipulated by demons. Like they have no room for Christian theology. And Mark Studdick is right in the middle of that, trying to figure out what's true. And he eventually figures out like, no, Christian theology, like these are demons. Which spoiler alert, if you haven't read that Hideous Strength.
It's so good.
But so I actually do think that the way he's giving this talk and him writing that Hideous Strength, like there are aspects of them both intertwined here. So like man ascending his throne, that's chapter 3 of Abolition of Man. But then nature is actually going to come back and slap man. That's Abolition chapter 3. So just some other Lewis-y ideas cropping up here.
As to the order, Is Theology Poetry was first read at the Socratic Club, November 6th, 1944, whereas the sermon, The Weight of Glory, was delivered 3 years earlier on June 8th in 1941. So if that quote is in there, it came first in Weight of Glory and later in this essay, which is strange. I would have thought it would have been reversed.
I don't know if it's in The Weight of Glory. Okay. I think it's in Meditations in a Toolshed. Oh, okay.
So then,
I might be misremembering, but there's a similar principle or concept in that essay.
Yep. True Lewis scholars would know this. The Thinklings podcast, we just make educated guesses.
I have one question for us to consider. So the way that Lewis begins the essay, and he's talking about how Christian theology would be inferior poetry to Greek and to Greek mythology and Norse mythology. Is that Lewis describing himself before he was converted or after he was converted? It seems as though he is saying that he still thinks that way, even now that he's been converted. But my question is that true? Because when we think about poetry that is appealing to us, it's poetry that is true. With my students, if I'm reading them poetry from a perspective that is untrue, they do not find it nearly as satisfying as poetry that is true. And I'm thinking about T.S. Eliot, for example, his great poem, The Wasteland, before he's converted. And when I say converted, Eliot joins the Anglican Church. So take that with a grain of salt. But a lot of critics who loved him and loved his poetry before his conversion say that after his conversion, his poetry was not nearly at the level of his pre-conversion poetry. I, as a Christian reader, find the opposite to be true. The Wasteland is interesting poetry, but incredibly dissatisfying and dark, whereas Ash Wednesday and Four Quartets and things like that are much more interesting now after his conversion. That's my long question.
So I think it's a really good question, and So Lewis is using himself personally as kind of the test case of the essay. And he does then pose a question, I think it's like paragraph 4 or 5, like, is my experience the outlier? And he, I think, assumes the answer is no. Like he does apply it generally. You off air, you read that statement at the very end where he talks about like the great myth gets boiled down to a man sleeping in a boat. Can you find that and read it? Because it almost seems like Lewis is making the incarnation seem less poetic, like less beautiful, less satisfying. Can you read that, Josh?
That is the humiliation of myth into fact, of God into man. What is everywhere and always imageless and ineffable, only to be glimpsed in dream and symbol. And the acted poetry of ritual becomes small, solid, no bigger than a man who can lie asleep in a rowing boat on the Lake of Galilee. You may say that this is, after all, is a still deeper poetry. I will not contradict you. The humiliation leads to a greater glory. but the humiliation of God and the shrinking or condescension of the myth as it becomes fact are also quite real.
I haven't thought about that, but that's actually like ingenious to think through how anti-mythical it is. Here is the Son of God. Mm-hmm. And what is he doing? Sleeping in a boat.
So basic, simple.
Yeah, so basic, so simple.
I do think, to your question, Josh, for Lewis, that does have less appeal. I don't know if that would be the common experience. But I don't know. I don't say that in a judgmental way of Lewis, but it seems like that's what he's saying of himself.
And I might even agree with him about that particular instance, but what about the Christ who comes back on a white steed with a sword, you know? That's poetic.
Yeah. It's a good question. And my thought was the things that are objective, truth, beauty, goodness. And I think most poetry focuses on, especially in his era, romantic poetry, it's focusing on the beauty. And so when you're, you know, thinking of like Wordsworth with like one of those like large landscapes that he describes, like pretty much anybody's going to read that and contemplate and can find the beauty in it. And we, I think, can understand what's good. But then when you ask sinful people to understand what's true, pre and post conversion, everyone's at a different place of understanding and realizing the magnitude of truths. And so I think there is different levels of poetic enjoyment in theology based on your sanctification, for sure. And so, you know, would Lewis have said the exact same thing in 1954 that he says in 1944? I don't know, but this is a good question. I want to read the quote about Freud because I think it's funny. But and then if you have any final thoughts, but then we'll transition. So this is in paragraph 20. And he's kind of in the midst of conclusion. So for all of these reasons, then, I think that those who accept theology are not necessarily being guided by taste rather than reason. So again, he's answering, is theology just poetry? Are we just choosing this because it's poems? No. But he slips in this little parenthesis. For all of these reasons, then, I think, though we knew even before Freud that the heart is deceitful.
So like, that's so good.
As if we needed someone to do psychoanalysis to tell us that men are bad. Like, so it's like that's a deep shot of like, we don't need Freud to tell us what the Bible tells us. Like, he's directly quoting Jeremiah. So that's a really good quote.
How great is it that all these years later, Freud is still catching strays?
But anyway.
So funny, because I thought he was saying Freud is deceived, but anyways, carry on.
Yeah, it's like, I think part of the context of that is like saying that the heart is deceitful and above all else, you know, desperately wicked. That's like a poetic statement. And the accusation to the Christian is that, oh, you just believe those things because it's poems. And it's like, we need Freud to give us science about how we're sinful, not the Bible. And it's like, actually, we knew it before. It doesn't matter if it's a poem. We don't need Freud. The Bible is true, and whether it's a poem or not. So thought that was a pretty fun quote. But any final thoughts on his theology poetry? I think it's a fun read. It is probably not as valuable as some of the other essays, just because of the way it blends the poetry discussion with theology, with apologetics. It's not doing one thing. So it's hard to read. It's kind of dense. It's good. I enjoyed it, but I have really weird tastes. So, you know, for what it's worth, it's good, but it's not an easy.
Yeah, I think any of these essays that you read are kind of like going to the gym intellectually. Like, it's good for you, but I'm with you. The value is maybe what you get out of it personally. Yeah. And I think sometimes he says some really, his wordsmithing is very good. I think, I'm with you. I think it's a good assessment.
If I was going to compare its practicality to the Inner Ring is like a 7 or an 8. This is like a 2 or a 3. Would we agree with that assessment?
I would. I think that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I liked his connection to the other, you know, I mean, assuming his definition of myth, which I can do, I don't have a problem with that. But then how he's evaluating them, that's a conversation I've never even thought of. So that's where I thought there was value. But I agree with your like weighting of the things. The inner ring was much more punchy.
Let's have a brief final meditation from God's word in Ephesians chapter 6. So in the very end of Ephesians, Paul has gone through the spiritual armor, which to me was fascinating. And I can't remember the last time I did a devotional and if I said this. So if I repeat myself, I'll say it again, but then I'm going to get to another point. In Ephesians chapter 6, Paul all throughout the book is talking about these supernatural spiritual forces. And in 6, he talks about the armor of God, and it's all humble means of walking with the Lord. You know, you are saved. You put your trust in the Lord. That's your shield. You walk in uprightness. That's your breastplate. You believe the truth. That's your belt. You share the gospel at a given moment. That's your shoes. It's just, it is a way of living according to what God would desire. Perhaps you'd even say living according to the Spirit. And then in verse 18, he says this, praying at all times in the Spirit with prayer and supplication. And then he adds this, he says, to that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all the saints and also for me. So Paul asks them to pray for him. So let's ask what he prays for. He says, that words may be given to me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, and that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak. What I think is interesting there is how educated was Paul. He was really educated. He knew his Old Testament really well. He wrote, you know, a lot of the New Testament. And so he was very intellectual. He was very smart. He was very capable. But what he's praying for is that God would help him, that he would have the words to say when he's being bold. So believer, if you have the opportunity to speak up for the Lord, whether that's fully proclaiming the gospel or whether it's simply speaking truth from the Bible to someone, and you are fearful and you'd like to be bold, but you don't know exactly how to say it, very simply, stop and pray that God would help you with the words to say. You don't have to be super intellectual like Paul. And there are lots of people in the Bible who are not known for their intellect, but they are speaking truth. And so we have a fun time thinking and trying to think well. We want to be good thinkers on this podcast. But at the end of the day, it's a humble but bold proclamation of that truth. And God will help you with that. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.